Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Gus Carter and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. Today's front pages are filled with stories suggesting that the UK may impose quarantine restrictions on travellers coming from France. Meanwhile, new 14-day restrictions have been imposed on Belgium, Andorra and the Bahamas. Katie, as luck would have it, you're joining us from Paris. How likely is it, do you think, that you will be told to isolate when you return?
My luck's going to depending on how the next few days go. I think what's interesting is clearly France is a country where we've heard coronavirus infection levels are going up. I'm not just saying this because I'd like to go home and not have to self-quarantine for 2 weeks, but it is not such a jump as we have seen in places like Spain. It clearly is the wrong direction it's going in. It's a high priority for the government to keep a track of, because if they were to, you know, miss something where they felt they needed a quarantine, it could actually have quite a large effect just because of the number of British tourists who do tend to go to France. But also for that same reason, I think while we have seen and we saw with Spain, the government is quite happy to make these quick decisions and just take the hit. It's interesting also listening to what the Chancellor said this morning, where he was saying, you know, we will not hesitate. I personally think that it is quite likely that he speaks to figures in government that most air bridges are perhaps not in place by the end of the month. But I think this is going to be a gradual thing, looking at the data as it goes.
I think Katie is right. I think that over time, more and more of these air bridges are going to fall away. The UK experience is quite unique in coronavirus, I think, in one way, which is it does appear that the virus was kind of seeded fairly evenly across the country because of people returning from half-time holidays in Italy and Spain. And I think that means that the government this time round will be quicker, pull up the drawbridge, close these air bridges down. I will be very, very surprised if the action on France takes place this quickly. There seems to be a pattern with this now once they've got going. Belgium has been in the mix for about a week. I think the sense is France has probably got until the next set of French data comes out to get more on top of the situation before the government pulls the ripcord there. I also think another consideration for the government, which it won't want to think about, but it might need to, is these other countries do not take kindly to this. The Spanish Prime Minister reacts very badly. I think, given what we know about Emmanuel Macron and his importance to the Brexit negotiations, I think he would not be backwards about coming forwards with his views on any attempt to limit travel to France.
James, new ONS data out today suggests that the UK's level of infection might actually be levelling off. Do you think this vindicates the government's strategy?
I think this ONS data was actually kind of quite encouraging. There was a lot of talk about whether there was the beginning of a kind of second spike. Looking at this ONS data, it does, as you say, it does seem to be levelling off. It doesn't seem to be going up, and it doesn't suggest that opening up the economy more has kind of sent cases skyrocketing. I think the big challenge for the government is that the test and trace numbers are less good. It is struggling to reach people. And can that get more specific data? The biggest thing the government needs to be able to do is do properly local lockdowns rather than these kind of regional lockdowns like we're seeing in Greater Manchester. I think that's the next challenge. I think the testing capacity in the UK is now up to 300,000. They have a capacity to do 300,000 tests a day. I think that needs to increase yet again and quite significantly, because I think given that the data suggests that about 80% of people who have coronavirus are asymptomatic at the moment, that would indicate that you need to have some mass testing to get on top of this virus.
Now, James, you say that the government has this capacity, the ability to do 300,000 tests a day. Is it actually using all of this at the moment?
No, it's not. And that's partly because, as we say, 80% of people who have coronavirus don't realise that they have it, don't have symptoms. They won't go and get a test. The challenge for the testing comes in November, December, when lots of people will have the symptoms of coronavirus, even though they don't have coronavirus, because it's flu season. So lots of people will have a cough, a cold, a temperature. Doesn't necessarily mean they'll have COVID. That's why you need all that spare capacity in the system to be able to test those people.
Moving on to another form of testing, A-level results are due imminently, I think, next week. There's growing consternation among students about the possibility that they may not be able to appeal if they're given a predicted grade that is not up to their expectations. Katie, is there a row coming down the tracks?
I think potentially, yes. And there'll be some type of row when the results come out. But ultimately, what's quite interesting is we are getting a pre-discussion before something happens, and is in part because it's already happened in Scotland. So in Scotland, there are exam results, and if you look at the various grades, some people got lower grades than they had hoped for. They weren't able to sit exams. And if you look at the system for adjustment, it seemed that in lots of poorer schools, there was a more of a downward adjustment. There's some say, well, this is just a system. This was how experts decided the best way to go about it was. But you can't deny that SNP have taken quite a big hit for this politically, a backlash, you know, which is not just the usual suspects when it comes to those who like to take a swipe at Sturgeon. It's been quite widespread. What it seems to have done, I think, is just alerted early those in England, you know, in Wales, to what is coming down the track. So schools in England at the moment, we found out today, now they can appeal if they can show the GCSE or A-level results they get do not reflect recent improvements. Now, this announcement has come after concerns about what was happening, you know, north of the border. So we've almost had the table slightly turning, one in exam results, but also just in terms of schools reopening. Scotland also has to do that first. So while I think this is a difficult challenge, I do get the sense that there are some in Westminster who are not unhappy to have a situation where Sturgeon's government is having to move first on these things and then just seeing where the cracks are.
James, getting schools reopened is the government's kind of number one priority at the moment. It's what they're looking towards next month. How are they planning on doing that? How are they going to be able to get people back, get children back, get teenagers back without the risk of a second infection?
I mean, as you say, that the challenges with secondary schools, I mean, the kind of general view is that primary schools won't have much of an effect. And you know, that's what the evidence, scientific evidence so far suggests. I think with secondary schools, ultimately, they hope to have cases low enough that they can deal with any uptick associated with schools. But I think if this is what is demanded, I think they are prepared to close other things to open schools. I think, and there are two reasons for this. I mean, A, obviously there is a kind of social justice issue here, which is, you know, as these exam results show, where in Scotland, poor kids got downgraded more than kids from middle class areas, there are clear problems there. There's also obviously a problem, which is, for a tragically large number of children, kind of school is a refuge from chaotic home lives. But the other reason is the closure of schools is perhaps the biggest single economic hit of the lockdown because of how it made it so much harder for parents to work. And so I think they'll be very, very keen if they're going to try and kind of keep everyone working to keep the schools open too.
Now, there were reports in the Times this morning that Number 10 is having difficulties filling the new vacancy left by Mark Sedwill. Apparently, all of the front runners have made clear that they're not interested in the job. James, surely this is the kind of dream job for any civil servant. Why are they finding it so difficult to fill the role?
I mean, there are two reasons why they're finding it so difficult. One is the role is not quite what the role was. Simon Case, the new permanent secretary at Number 10, will take on some of the responsibilities that previous cabinet secretaries have had. And then I think the second thing is that, you know, everyone thinks there is going to be a bust up coming over Whitehall reform between the civil service and the government. And I think quite a lot of people don't fancy spending the next 3 years caught in the middle of that particular fight, and hence their desire not to do the job. I think it is an interesting case as to whether these people who've not applied, whether if they were given a nudge, might change their minds.
Katie, Number 10 have made no secret of the fact that they're planning major reforms for the civil service. Could it actually help them to bring in an outsider to do this job?
I think it's such a senior job. It's not really one where there's even a sense in Downing Street you'd probably bring in an outsider to it. I think there's definitely a drive in the sense of lots of Lee's civil service points in the future, but also just these advisory roles where they want to bring in people with outside experience. But I think it was more likely, and we saw this with the woman who's just been appointed as the permanent secretary in Bays, someone who had private sector experience, so was at McKinsey, then ended up working in the civil service and then gets promoted. And I think that's probably the format which, in terms of when they're looking at candidates, I think that particularly for the most senior roles, you need someone who knows how it works, but I think ideally they will have experience on top of that from the private sector, which they're bringing in.
James, this was kind of one of the problems with Sedwill, wasn't it? That people in Number 10 were saying they were asking him to pull levers and nothing was happening. You know, they were saying, can we get this done? And things just weren't working in quite the same way as they were under his predecessor.
I mean, there are two two issues here. One is that Mark Sedwell was a kind of securocrat by nature, and here he was handling a kind of very domestic policy-based crisis. And then I think the second is that Jeremy Hayward was a quite exceptional civil servant, and he had almost designed a machine that almost only he knew how to drive. And I think that was part of the problem, which was, you know, other people just didn't know how to work it as skillfully and as well as he did. I mean, the new cabinet secretary, their job will be more being head of a civil service than anything else. But it will be very interesting to see who does end up doing it and then how that fits into the broader dynamic between government and the civil service.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And thank you for listening.
Before you go, why not subscribe to The Spectator? For just £12, you can get 12 issues of the magazine delivered to your door, full access to our website, and we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher. Absolutely free. Forget Eat Out to help out. This is the offer people are raving about, or at least that's what the producer to this podcast says. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.